On Mondays, we talk with Andrew Egger, White House correspondent from The Bulwark and co-author of Morning Shots, a newsletter you can have delivered straight to your inbox. Andrew is with us today on KMOX. Good morning, Andrew.
Hey, guys. Good morning. How you doing?
Hey, we're doing okay. How's Mitch McConnell doing? Because it looks like they have released another photo of him and apparently being released from the hospital. What do we know?
Yes. So this is a new statement just breaking this morning. We have another photo of Mitch McConnell and his wife, Elaine Chao, another statement basically saying he's not yet cleared to resume, you know, going to events and things like this. They are somewhat worried about minimizing the risk of another fall, which is what put him in the hospital in the first place, but that he is well, that he's recovering. This is, again, everything that we're getting from this statement from his office and from his doctors. Mitch McConnell obviously has not been around D.C. now for a number of weeks. There have been a lot of conspiracy theories swirling around his departure. If I were Mitch McConnell, I might release a video statement. I don't know. But you can only spend so much time and effort, slapping down online rumors. And he's always been sort of notoriously private in his personal life. So I guess I kind of understand why they are taking this approach. But it's a pressing matter. I mean, they really do need him back if they're going to try to get any legislation passed for the remainder of the summer. It's a slim majority that they have in the Senate, and they need every senator they can get, even though he's obviously no longer the majority leader there.
Yeah, and you know, we've had ailing senators and representatives before, and we've had elderly senators and representatives, who are in office, I think, long past the time that they should have been. So it's not so much that Mitch McConnell being in the hospital or being absent is that unusual. Isn't most of this just all around the lack of transparency surrounding his condition?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, a lot of this is structural stuff, right? I mean, you said we've had ailing senators before, but we really are in an environment, a social media environment now, where these stories can take on a life of their own, where there's so little trust, just sort of around Congress in general and around the information that we get digitally, period. Like, a couple of years ago, a statement from a senator's office and a picture of them kind of smiling at the camera and being like, hey, I'm still here, I'm doing great. I mean, that would put a lot of rumors to rest. Now, of course, we're in this sort of AI-drenched age where trust in all of our institutions is at an all-time low, where there's a lot of people who make their money in sort of the political influencer sphere, kicking up, more and more theories about things not being the way they appear. And so there just is a higher level of scrutiny just in a vacuum. And when you add to that the fact that we are coming off of a range of stories of different lawmakers, different federal lawmakers being absent for unexplained periods of time. There was a Republican congressman who was battling depression in the hospital, whose absence was not explained for a period of months. When you're coming off of stories like Dianne Feinstein and her advanced age and just sort of deterioration, guys like Joe Biden, right? I mean, the president of the United States faced a lot of these exact same sorts of critiques just because he was quite old and there were a lot of significant questions about his health. And I think that the environment is only going to continue to grow more suspicious for all of these things. And obviously it goes along with sort of a political critique that we're seeing more and more from different people in both parties about a need for generational change in leadership, for getting younger blood in to various positions in terms of political power. And all that stuff is in the background of this, what would otherwise be just sort of a story of a pretty old lawmaker who has been hospitalized after a fall.
Oil prices have come back a bit. That's after the U.S. and Iran have some sort of, I don't know if you want to call it a ceasefire, but I guess it's that at the moment. How much staying power, though, does this pause in the strikes have?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I feel like I keep coming on this show every week and giving some version of the same basic case analysis of the president being pulled between two bad options here, right? I mean, what he would like is for his threats of violence against Iran to just shake them out of their senses and make them be willing to offer more concessions that we don't actually have to go get than we've gotten so far. But what we saw on Friday, after 2 weeks of Trump saying, well, this negotiating stuff isn't going so great, let's go back to pummeling them and see if that shakes anything loose. We got 2 weeks of that. Then last week, we got another round of really strong you know, violent rhetoric from the president. Like, if Iran keeps blowing up boats in the Strait of Hormuz, or not blowing them up, if Iran keeps firing on boats in the Strait of Hormuz, we're going to start blowing up bridges and power plants. So back to that really maximalist rhetoric. But then you get to Friday, as was reported in several outlets, the White House gets together and they basically say to the president, look, you can go through with this if you want to go through with this. And we think we will have, you know, tactical success with these operations if we do. We have a lot of military supremacy, to state it mildly, in the region. But you have to be willing to experience some blowback across a number of axes. You need to understand that, you know, that you could see mass civilian casualties with this sort of thing. You need to be worried about the level of the missiles that we have stockpiled after so many weeks and months of war, and that's getting pretty low. And what we saw then coming out of that meeting was three days now of cessation in these strikes. It's hard to read the tea leaves of this any more than we already have, in terms of, again, the White House bouncing back and forth between not getting very much at the negotiating table and then not getting very much in terms of concessions from conflict. But one thing that we have seen from Iran today was them coming out and saying, yes, we are talking with Oman right now about how to sort of regularize maritime operations inside the Strait of Hormuz. To read the tea leaves of that a little bit, these are the two countries that would basically need to strike a bilateral deal about charging tolls in the Strait of Hormuz in perpetuity going forward. So where previously we had this international waterway with free travel for any country that needed to make use of it, we are now perhaps inching toward a world where Iran and Oman control who gets in and who gets out, or at the very least get to scrape a good amount financially off the top of travel through this waterway. So very a far cry from what the United States has demanded, from where the status quo was before the beginning of this war. We will see whether it ends up being a status quo that the White House is willing to allow to persist in the aftermath of this. But again, as I keep saying, it's not clear that they have a lot of really good options short of massive military action of the sort that we haven't seen yet, and that it's not at all clear there'd be political will for in this country.
We're speaking with Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark. And Andrew, Senate conservatives, some led by Senator Mike Lee, are calling on Senate Majority Leader John Thune to cancel the August recess so that they can all debate President Trump's number one legislative priority, the Save America Act. Where do we stand with the Save America Act? I was getting the impression that this thing just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to pass.
Well, I don't think we've seen anything yet that should cause you to reevaluate that. I mean, the bottom line here is that this is a piece of legislation that doesn't have the votes in the Senate. There are a number of Republican lawmakers who don't like the package as a package. They might be okay with some electoral reforms. They might, for instance, be okay with some form of national voter ID. That's pretty popular, actually, among a number of people in this country. It polls very well. But as far as this particular legislative package is concerned, which Trump has really staked his reputation to and staked his entire domestic agenda to, I mean, he has repeatedly even been willing to kind of sabotage other pieces of legislation that he likes in an attempt to put more pressure on the Senate to pass this thing. But when we look at efforts like this from Mike Lee, I mean, this is, at least in my read, very much a matter of winning a certain kind of online popularity contest among Republicans. You want to be seen as the senator who is doing the most to push this top priority of the president's through. Mike Lee is taking advantage of that. He's getting a lot of accolades on Twitter for being the guy who's calling for this thing by being willing to make John Thune the bad guy. But John Thune supports the Save America Act. And this is a thing we've seen from the leader, from Leader Thune for weeks now, basically him saying, what the heck do you want me to do? Like, I'm for it. Most of my conference is for it. There's not a majority that's for it. There are a number of holdouts here that we just don't have the votes to pass this. If the White House is that concerned about passing this piece of legislation, it should get those senators on the phone, and it should be putting the pressure on them. Why am I the bad guy here is kind of the line that Thune has had to take. But I mean, we were talking about McConnell a little bit ago. It's really hard. It's really hard to be sort of the face of what is seen as a Republican establishment in this extremely anti-establishment moment. That's true in both parties, but it is certainly true of the MAGA movement right now, of the current Republican Party, because the president has sort of seen fit to cast his pretty stalled out domestic agenda as a factor, not of him, you know, pushing for legislation that just doesn't have majority support in the Senate, but as, you know, some sort of shadow Republican establishment still sort of working to frustrate him behind the scenes.
But also there was this this bill coming out of the House, the Stop Insider Trading Act, which I think most of us are kind of on board with the idea of that. However, they attached an amendment to it, which is basically the SAVE Act. So they put them together and that passed. But most Democrats, if not all of them, voted against it. So what about that bill? Does that have much chance of ultimately becoming law?
I don't think that there's anything that is look, anything could happen, right? I don't think it is very likely that we are going to see the current SAVE Act in its current permutation attached to any rider that will force it through. I think what we may see, and there has been some chatter about this in various parts of the Senate, is maybe they try to carve it up a little bit. Maybe they try to find some portions of the SAVE Act and sort of triangulate for, well, what's a elections legislative package that could get some of these Republican holdouts, could maybe even get a couple of Democratic votes, but would still be enough to sort of placate the president and let him move on, you know, mentally and emotionally onto any number of these other things. I mean, we're in a weird moment right now because Republicans have basically passed one piece of legislation in this whole first year and a half that they've had a trifecta in the government, that they've controlled the House and the Senate and the White House. And that was the One Big Beautiful Bill last year, which did a lot of stuff, but which has been kind of a tough sell. I mean, there was some political polling just out this morning basically saying a lot of people, when they think of that bill, they're like, yeah, that probably helped some people out financially, but it didn't do that much for me. And Republicans have had a hard time making the connection between that and any increase in prosperity. So they're looking for other things, you know, other legislative wins they might be able to notch this summer before everybody's really done and really just back in their districts campaigning. And meanwhile, you have the president really singularly fixated on this this elections bill, this Save America Act. And there's this real disconnect between what most Republican legislators would like to see, which is something, some new win somewhere on affordability or something that's sort of populist like this, like what you were just talking about, insider trading type stuff. And it has been an enormous amount of labor for House and Senate leadership to try to find some common ground with the White House on this. And so far they're coming up empty. So we'll see what happens. But it's been a source of a lot of frustration for a lot of Republicans right now.
Andrew, I feel like I'm just surrounded by crazy currently. But we are seeing a lot of rhetoric coming out of the Democratic Socialists of America, just kind of their rise with some DSA candidates registering as Democrats and thus winning, you know, being able to win some of these elections. But the DSA chair, who was recently interviewed on Fox, was pretty open about their beliefs. They would like to abolish the Senate, defund the Pentagon, abolish prisons, and so forth. Not your standard Democratic platform. Even progressive Democrats aren't for abolishing the Senate. So my question is, on the Hill, you know, in D.C., how much traction, how much support is the DSA platform really getting among Democrats?
Well, if you're talking about among actual elected Democrats, the answer is very little. I mean, this is not something that appeals to any except for a very small clutch, primarily in the House of progressive legislators. When it comes to America writ large, there's this really strange disconnect that's happening right now, because if you went down the list of all of those specific policy positions and polled them all, you would not get an enormous amount of support for any of those things. I mean, if you go down that list, you're basically abolishing all of the basic structures of America as a political unit in the world today. It's a pie in the sky platform, to put it mildly. At the same time, a lot of these DSA-type progressives have been getting a lot of traction politically just because the Democratic brand is seen as so tarnished and so damaged by the party's inability to stand up to Donald Trump and to withstand specifically his return. And there's this enormous sort of insurgent anti-establishment energy among the voter base where they don't necessarily like these DSA candidates for any of that stuff that you're talking about right now, but they just see them as more willing to not knife fight with the president and with Republicans than the Democrats that are in office right now. And it's a real problem. It's a problem for Democrats, and it's a problem that we've seen just you know, real recently. This is exactly the kind of thing that we saw in the wake of Trump's election in 2016. Was you had a wave of real fury among the Democratic base at its own establishment that would have allowed a guy like this to come along and clean their clocks in the first place. They you know, kind of swerved to the left on a bunch of these policy issues and in terms of a bunch of policy rhetoric specifically, and then that comes back to bite them a lot in the next couple cycles where Republicans hang things like defund the police around Democrats' necks and use it to sink them in a lot of winnable races. And I think what a lot of sort of more normie Democrats or more establishment Democrat types are worried about is seeing the same thing happen right now, that there's this massive backlash against the president, against what he's doing to the country in a lot of these areas, but that some of the people who are coming forward to channel that backlash are going to end up sparking a backlash of their own that then Republicans on the swing back of the pendulum will be able to capitalize another cycle or two down the road. And they do not seem to have a very good strategy for forestalling that or preventing that, again, because some of these candidates are so good at channeling that kind of insurgent rage.
Thank you, Andrew Egger, as always, and we will talk again next week.
Thanks a lot, guys.